Penguin Random House Audio presents Supper Club by Lara Williams. Read for you by Stephanie Martini.
The Fearful are caught. Lena was the first. We met her in a cafe with cloudy grey furnishings and a needless accumulation of potted plants. The tables were covered with magazines that had titles like Wheat Sheaf and Gardenia, their covers featuring tanned girls with ribboning limbs, all pigtails and peasant dresses. One by one, Stevie turned them upside down. Lena messaged us from outside and we watched her do it, crinkling her nose at the beginnings of rain. I'm outside. Shall I come inside? I mean, shall I meet you inside? Where are you sat? Sorry, I just hate not knowing where to sit. Are you near the back window? I think I can see you. Okay. I can't see you. I'm heading in now. Sorry. Lena had blonde hair knotted over her shoulder. She wore a navy cord suit and a white silk shirt. Her bulky trainers were incongruous to her outfit. She explained she wears them to and from work, but in the office is required to wear heels. She worked as an office manager at an expensive hotel. It was reasonably paid. She'd get a discounted Caesar salad in the hotel bistro for lunch, plus use of the steam room and sauna. But she worked a 50-hour week and once got docked pay for having chipped her nail varnish on the tram. And watching all of the rooms being used for affairs, and worse, for ordering sex workers, had made her paranoid about her husband's fidelity. At first, it was the middle-aged couples leering over the counter, drunk and conspicuous, like we couldn't believe their audacity. She wore a thin gold bracelet, which she rolled between her fingers, spinning it in circles against her skin until it left a faint red mark. Then it was the younger ones, women asking which lift would take them to room 33, their eyes never really leaving the floor, walking out of the hotel still adjusting their clothes. Stevie and I made notes, me scribbling into a notepad, Stevie tapping at her phone. We didn't know what we were collating at that point, but the data felt urgent and indispensable. Lena's round face turning pink. But it was the sex workers that got to me, and the men who used them, these completely ordinary-looking men. Lena's obsession began with the women, eyeing the sizes of their waists, scrutinising their faces, wondering whether he might find them attractive. She'd think about the way they dressed, whether her husband might want her to dress like that. The women, of course, mostly weren't sex workers, but to her they might as well all have been. These other women, with their lipstick and their lacquered hair, all offering something else, something new, something she never could, being in possession of just the one human body, and trying to make a penny off it too. She wondered whether she hated these women or if she was afraid of them, whether there was a difference. She became fixated on the idea that her husband must be having an affair or using sex workers, or that he eventually would. She'd follow him home from work, leaving her own work early, making up doctor's appointments or dentist checkups, taking Ubers across town. She'd sit on the other side of the square outside the recruitment agency where he worked, having already taken note of the colours he was wearing that morning in order to better spot him. She'd follow him on the opposite side of the street, a few feet behind, her gaze fixed on him diagonally across the road. She'd trail him into shops on the way home from work, ducking behind the bread counter in Tesco. Once she held an especially large watermelon out in front of her head, so she could walk past him undetected and check the contents of his basket, jazz apples, cooked ham, Ritz crackers. She would trace him all the way to the station, where he would sometimes stop for a drink at the station pub, not telling her, saying he had to work late. And if he was lying about this, then what else was he lying about? Dishonesty, she felt, was a spectrum. You might be on the less dangerous end, but you were still on it, prone to slip up, slide further along, depending on the circumstances. She wouldn't stop until she had followed him all the way to their front door. Then she would crouch down, sometimes crawl on her hands and knees, hiding behind the brick wall that fronted their home. She would wait there for 30 minutes, sometimes an hour, until she was sure, until she was absolutely certain he wasn't going back out. After he had gone to bed, she would stay up late to devour his internet activity, scrolling through his history after he'd fallen asleep. She downloaded a keystroke logger to their downstairs desktop, finding out all his passwords and accounts. When her husband used the bathroom or showered in the morning, or popped out to buy a pint of milk, she would check his phone, reading his texts, looking at his photos, reviewing his outgoing calls. She found out what kind of pornography he liked and that sometimes he looked up his old girlfriends on Facebook. But no sex workers. Never sex workers. She began feeling almost resentful at his inactivity, thinking about all the well-dressed businessmen who ordered champagne and Chateaubriand, who wouldn't patch through their wives' telephone calls. Did he really think he was better than them? It became a routine of sorts. The following. The checking up. The phone. One Saturday afternoon, he went to watch the football, and she noticed his phone left behind on the kitchen counter. She didn't even think about it. It was instinctive. Perched against the oven, she opened his messages. A text from an unknown number. Thanks for last night. Let's do it again soon. How much do I owe you for the room? Punctuated by an image of lips, clavicle, ribcage and breasts. She stared at the message for a while, worrying she had imagined it, that she had literally willed it into existence. She waited for the anger, the disappointment, the betrayal she had anticipated to course through her veins, surprised when all she actually felt, was relief. It was over. It had happened. And it didn't hurt that bad. That's why I'm here, she told us. That's why I want to do this. Stevie and I could not contain ourselves. We squeezed hands underneath the table. She grinned back at us. You're in, Stevie said. We've not got a date for the first one yet, I added, or a venue, but we're looking. Probably something next month. We finished our drinks and told her more about our vision for Supper Club. We told her about the ethos, about what we hoped the events would look like, the sort of women we were looking to recruit. So your husband, Stevie said, did you leave him after you found out? Oh no, she replied, perhaps a little dreamily. We stay together. We're kind of happier than we've ever been. It's weird to think, she added. It was just one year, just one really peculiar year, but it changed my life forever. Stevie's face changed. That's ridiculous, she said, forever teetering on the precipice of hostility, never afraid to speak her mind. Don't you think that's ridiculous, Roberta? She turned to me, to put an emphasis on one arbitrary stretch of time that's, you know, a total construct. I mean, we are all just these giant accumulations of stuff and experiences and talking and things happening to us. You can't break a human life down into years and say that one really means something. Lena looked embarrassed. She began fiddling with her bracelet again. Roberta, Stevie said. Roberta, don't you agree? I half smiled. Out of generosity or discomfort, it was often hard to say. And I didn't say that I didn't agree, but I didn't say that I did. Expectations. The September I left for university, colour clung to the branches. There is something particularly unbearable about being sad in the heat. The terrible knapsack of it, carrying it around like a heavy load. Something between melancholy and nerves, a blank no man's land lousy with the lethargy of hot weather. Who can be bothered? On my last morning at home, I looked out at the cemetery that backed my bedroom window. I hooked open the latch and pushed forward the glass pane, swinging my legs over the ledge, lighting a cigarette and exhaling thin curls of smoke towards the graves. Growing up next to a cemetery had made me flippant about death. It was as perfunctory as chopping cabbage beside my mum, Van Morrison on the radio, the dog expectant beside our legs, flipping scraps of veg to the floor. Hearses dragged slowly past our house, but so did rubbish trucks and milk vans. Families sobbed and howled. We turned up the TV. Sometimes I liked to pretend my own dad was dead, imagining the funeral, what I might say, what hymns might be sung, whether there would be any readings or speeches. I got a strange satisfaction from thinking about it. He wasn't dead, of course, just gone. He'd left when I was 7, and though my mum encouraged me to stay in touch with him, eventually I stopped replying to his letters, wouldn't answer his phone calls. So I was used to the vagaries of loss, the spaces left behind, my dad's absence apparent in the most peculiar ways. The suite of friends' husbands that swung by, each offering a particular trade or service, fixing a clog in the gutter, ringing the council about streetlights. Not that my mum was incapable. She was a problem solver, resourceful in a way I've never since witnessed. Some things come better from a man, she would tell me, wearily. though I could...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?